fathers of the guides and probins and the Bengal lancers, and the only thing to stop them at full tilt was a horse soldier as good as themselves. He was there, and he chose his time. A few more seconds and the gallop would have been a charge. But now a trumpet sounded on the right, and wheeling out before our squares came the remnant of our own mounted division, the blue tunics and sabres of the Third Lights, and the black fezes and lances of the native cavalry, with white at their head, launching themselves at the charge against the enemy's flank. They didn't have the numbers, they didn't have the weight, and they were spent, man and beast. But they had the time and the place to perfection, and in a twinkling the Khalsa charge was a struggle and confusion of rearing beasts and falling riders and flashing steel as the lights tore into its heart and the Sowar lancers raked across its front. My female and civilian readers may wonder how this could be, that a small force of horsemen could confound one far greater. Well, that's the beauty of the flank attack. Think of six hearty chaps racing forward in line, and one artful dodger barges into the end man from the side. They're thrown out of kilter, tumbling into one another, and though they're 6-1, five of 'em can't come up at their attacker. At its best, a good flank movement can roll up the enemy like a window blind, and while White's charge didn't do that, it threw them quite off course. And when that happens to cavalry in formation, their momentum's gone, and good loose riders can play the devil with them. So, what happened under our noses was a deuce of a scrimmage, and though White's horse went down, he was here and there like a wildcat on foot, with the lights closing round him, the sabres swinging, and Goff up in his stirrup shouting, "You'll do, Mick! That's your sort, me boy! And who?" he roars at me. "Are those fellas, will you tell me?" I shouted that they were Khalsa regulars, not Garachara. Mouton's and Fuchs's regiments for certain, and Gordon's too, though I couldn't be sure. "That's the pick of them, then," snaps he. "Well, White's put a flea in their ears, so he has. Now take you this glass and tell me about their infantry. West, note it down." So, while the cavalry rumpus petered out, with the Khalsa horsemen drawing off, and our own fellows, half of them dismounted, limping back to reform, I surveyed that mass of infantry with a sinking heart, calling them off by name. Allards, Courts, Avitabiles, Delusts, Alvarines, and the rest of the divisions. The standards were easy to read, and so were those grim, bearded faces, sharp in my glass. I could even make out the silver buckles on the black cross-belts, the aigrettes in the turbans and the buttons on the tunics, white and red and blue and green, just as I'd seen them on Mayan Mir. How the devil came they here? Had Tedge's colonels lost patience and made him march to the sound of the guns? That must be it. And now that White had played our last card, we could only wait for them to advance and swallow us. The victory of Firoza Shah had become a death-trap, and I remembered Gardner's words. "They reckon they can whip John Company." And now John Company could barely stand up in his shot-torn squares, his pouches and magazines empty, his guns silent, his cavalry lame, and only his bayonets left. Across the plain, spurts of flame flickered along the Khalsa batteries like an electric storm, followed by the thunder of the discharge, the howl of shot overhead, and a hideous crashing and screaming as it burst open our squares. They were making sure, the bastards, pounding us to death at leisure before sending in their foot regiments to cut up the remains. Again the dust boiled up as the grape and round shot tore through the entrenchments. We could stand, or we could run. John Company chose to stand, God knows why. In my case, he stood as close behind Goff as might be, too scared even to pray. And a bad choice of position it was, too. For as the bombardment reached its height and the squares vanished in the rolling red clouds, and our army died by inches, with men going down like skittles and the blood running under our hooves, and some heroic ass bawling, "Die hard, Queen's Own!" and Flashy wondering if he dared cut out under the eye of his chief, and knowing I hadn't the game for it, and even my wound forgotten as the deadly ale swept through us, Suddenly Gough wheeled his horse, looking right and left at the wreck of his army, and the old fellow was absolutely weeping. Then he flung away his hat, and I heard him growl, "I never was bait, and I never will be bait. West, Flashman, follow me." And he wheeled his charger and went racing out into the plain. "You fall on your bloody sword if you want to, Paddy," thinks I, and would have stood my ground or dived for cover more like. But Charlie was away like a shot. My beast followed suit like the idiot cavalry screw he was. I clutched at the bridle with my shattered hand, near fainted at the pain, and found myself careering in their wake. For a moment I thought the old fellow had gone crazy and was for charging the Kelsar on his own, but he veered away right, making for the flank square, and as he galloped clear of it and suddenly reined in on his haunches and rose in his stirrups with his arms wide, I saw what he was at. All India knew that white coat of Gough's, the famous fighting coat, that the crazy old son of a bitch had been flaunting at his foes for 50 years. From South Africa and the peninsula to the northwest frontier. Now he was using it to draw the fire from his army to himself, and the two unlucky gallopers whom the selfish old swine had dragged along. It was the maddest brain trick you ever saw, and damnation, it worked. I can see him still, holding the tails out and showing his teeth, his white hair streaming in the wind, and the earth exploding round him. For the Sikh gunners took the bait and hammered us with everything they had, and, of course, we weren't hit. Try turning your batteries on 3 men at 1,000 yards and see what it gets you. But you don't reckon mathematical probabilities with a hurricane of shot whistling about your ears. I forced my beast alongside him and yelled, "Sir Hugh, you must withdraw. The army cannot spare you, sir." Which was inspiration, if you like, but wasted on that Irish idiot. He yelled something that I couldn't hear. And then the miracle happened. And if you don't believe it, look in the books. All of a sudden the firing died away, and across the plain the bugles rang out, and the drums rolled. The great gold banners were raised in the rays of the setting sun, and the Kelsar began to move. It came on in column by regiments, with a line of Jat light infantry leading, green figures with their pieces at the trail. And suddenly Charlie West was shouting, "Look, sir, you, our cavalry, the guns, my God, they're retiring." Not before time, thinks I. Though it shocked me, I can tell you. For he was right. Where we sat, perhaps a furlong ahead of our right flank, we had a clear view of the appalling ruin of our army. The dozen battered squares of red figures with great gaps in their ranks, the regimental colours stirring in the evening wind, the bodies sprawled on the earthworks, the plain before them littered with dead and dying beasts and men, the whole hideous scene mantled in dust and smoke from the charred wreckage. And the cavalry, what was left of it, was trotting away southward across the front of our left-hand squares, which were inclined slightly back from those on the right. They were in column by troops, native lancers and irregular horse, and then the third lights, with the horse guns following, bouncing along behind the teams.
They can't be running," cries West. "Sir Hugh, shall I ride to 'em, sir? It must be a mistake, surely."
Gough was staring after them as though he'd seen a ghost. I guess it was something he'd not seen in half a century. Horse and guns leaving the infantry to their fate. But he didn't stare more than a moment. "After 'em, West! Bring 'em back!" he snapped. And mad Charlie was away, head down and heels in, drumming up the dust, while Gough turned to look again towards the Kelsar. They were well out on the plain now, in splendid style, infantry in the centre with the horse guns at intervals among them, cavalry on the wings. Gough motioned to me, and we began to trot back towards our position. For the first time I saw Harding, with a little knot of officers, just in front of the right-hand squares. He was looking through a glass, and turning his head to call an order. The kneeling squares stood up, the men closing on each other, pieces at the present, the dying sun flickering on the line of bayonets. Gough reined up.
"Here'll do as well as any place,"
says he, and shaded his eyes to look across the plain. "Man, but there's a fine sight, is it not? Fit to gladden a soldier's heart, so it is. Well, here's to them. And to us." He nodded to me. "Thank you, me son." He threw back the tail of his coat and drew his sabre, loosing the frog, to let the scabbard fall to the ground. "I think we're all going home," says he. I glanced over my shoulder. Behind me the plain was open beyond our right flank, with jungle not a mile away. My screw wasn't blown or lame, and I was damned if I'd wait here to be butchered by that juggernaut tramping inexorably towards us. The blare of their heathen music came before them, and behind it the measured thunder of 40,000 feet. From the squares came the hoarse shouts of command. I stole another look at the distant jungle, tightening my sound hand on the bridle. "Dear God!" exclaims Goff, and I started guiltily round. And what I saw was another impossibility, but there it was. The Khalsa had halted in its tracks. The dust was eddying up before the advance line of Jats. They were turning to look back at the main body. We could hear voices shrilling orders, and the music was dying away in a discordant wail. The great standards seemed to be wavering. The whole vast army was stirring like a swarm. The rattle of a single kettle drum was taken up, repeated from regiment to regiment. And then it was as though a Venetian blind had opened and closed across the front of that great host. It was the ranks turning about, churning up the dust, and then they were moving away. The Khalsa was in full retreat. There wasn't a sound from our squares. Then from somewhere behind me a man laughed, and a voice called angrily for silence. That's the only noise I remember, but I wasn't paying much heed. I could only watch in stricken bewilderment as 20,000 of the best native troops in the world turned their backs on an exhausted, helpless enemy, and left the victory to us. Goff sat his horse like a statue, staring after them. A full minute passed before he chucked the reins, turning his mount. As he walked it past me towards the squares, he nodded and says, "You get that hand seen to, do you hear? And when you're done with it, I'll be obliged for the return of me neckerchief." So, that was Feroza Shah, as I saw it. The Indian Waterloo, the bloodiest battle we ever fought in the Orient, and certainly the queerest. And while other accounts may not tally with mine, or with each other's, on small points, all are agreed on the essentials. We took Feroza Shah, at terrible cost, in 2 days of fighting. And were at the end of our tether when Tej Singh hove in view with an overwhelming force, and then sheered off when he could have eaten us for dinner. The great controversy is, why did he do it? Well, you know why, because I've told you. He kept his word to us, and betrayed his army and his country. Yet, there are respected historians who won't believe it, to this day. Some because they claim the evidence isn't strong enough. Others because they just won't have it that victory was won by anything other than sheer British valour. Well, it played its part. By God it did. But the fact is it wouldn't have been enough without Tej's treachery. One of the things which confuses the historians is that Tej himself, who could lie truth out of India when he wanted to, told so many different stories afterwards. He assured Henry Lawrence that he didn't push home his attack because he was sure it must fail. Having seen the losses we'd taken in capturing Feroza Shah, he decided it was a hopeless position to assail now that we were defending it. He told the same tale to Sandy Abbott. Well, that's all in the eye. He knew his strength, and he knew we were at the last gasp. So that won't wash. Another lie, repeated to Alec Gardner, was that he was off collecting reserves at the time. If that's so, and he wasn't even there, who gave the Khalsa the order to turn about? The truth, I believe, is what he told me many years later. He'd have stayed before Ferozepore till the Sutlej froze, if his colonels hadn't forced him to march to the battle. And once inside of Feroza Shah, he was in a pickle, because he could see that victory was his for the taking. He had to think up some damned fine excuse for not overwhelming us. And chance provided it, at the last moment, when our guns and cavalry inexplicably withdrew, leaving our infantry as lonely as the policeman at Herne Bay. "Now's your time, Tedge," cries the Kalsa. "Give the word and the day's ours." "Not a bit of it," says clever Tedge. "Those crafty bastards ain't withdrawing at all. They're circling round to take us flank and rear. Back to the Sutlej, boys. I'll show you the way." And the Kalsa did as they were told. Well, you can see why. The 3 days of Moodki and Feroza Shah had given their rank and file a great respect for us. They didn't realize what poor fettle we were in, or that the withdrawal of our horse and artillery was, in fact, an appalling mistake. It looked as though it might have some sinister purpose to it, as Tedge was suggesting, and while they suspected his courage and character, rightly, they also knew he wasn't a bad soldier and might be right for once. So they obeyed him, and we were saved when we should have been massacred. You may ask why our cavalry and guns unexpectedly flew off into the blue, giving Tedge his excuse for retreating. Well, that was a gift from the gods. I told you that Lumley, the adjutant general, had gone balmy during the first day's fighting and kept saying we must retire on Ferozepore. Well, on the second day, all his screws came loose together. He got Ferozepore on the brain entirely, and at the height of the battle he ordered our guns and cavalry away. In Harding's name, if you please. So off they went, with the great loony urging them to make haste. So, that's how it was. Mickey White, Tedge Singh, and Lumley, each doing his little bit in his own way. Odd business, war. We'd lost 700 dead and close on 2,000 wounded, including your humble obedient who spent the night under a tree almost freezing to death and utterly famished, with Harding and what was left of his staff. There was no sleep to be had, with my hand throbbing in agony, but I daren't bleat for Abbott alongside me had 3 wounds to my 1, and was cheerful enough to sicken you. Round about dawn, Baksu the butler rolled up with some chapatis and milk, and when we'd wharfed it down and Harding had prayed a bit, we all crawled aboard an elephant and lumbered down to Ferozepore, which was to be our seat of government henceforth, while Gough and most of the army camped near Feroza Shah. It was a great procession of wounded and baggage all the way to Ferozepore, and when we reached the entrenchments, who should emerge but the guns and cavalry who had abandoned ship at the fatal moment? Harding was in a bait to know why, and one of the Binky Nabobs, the artillery commanders, assured him it had been on urgent orders from Harding himself, transmitted by the adjutant general. So now the cry was Lumley, and presently he appeared, very brisk, and with a wild glint in his eye, lashing the air with a fly-whisk and giving sharp little cries. He was dressed in pyjamas and a straw boater, and was plainly on his way to the Hatter's for tea. Harding demanded why he'd sent off the guns, and Lumley looked fierce and said they'd needed fresh magazines, of course, and damned if he'd known where they could get any bar for Ferozepore. He sounded quite indignant.
12 miles away?" cries Harding. "What service could they hope to do in time, supposing they had replenished?"
Lumley snapped back. "About as much as they'd have done at Feroza Shah, with no charges left." He seemed quite pleased with this, and laughed loudly, swatting flies, while Harding went purple.
"And the cavalry, then?" cries he. "Why did you bid them retire?"
"Escort," says Lumley, picking imaginary mice off his shirt. "Can't have guns going about unguarded, desperate fellas everywhere. Sikhs, don't you know? Swoop, pounce, carry 'em off, I assure you. Besides, cavalry needed a rest. Quite played out."
"And you did this in my name, sir?"
cries Harding.
"Without my authority?"
Lumley said impatiently that if he hadn't, no one would have paid him any heed. He grew quite agitated in describing how on the first night he'd told Harry Smith to retreat, and Harry had told him to go to hell.
"Using foulest language, sir. Damn the orders, his very words. Though I said 'twas in your name, and the battle was lost, and we must buy the six if we were to come off, he wouldn't listen," says Lumley, looking ready to cry.
Well, everyone except Harding could see that the fellow was liable to start plaiting his toes into doormats, but our pompous G.G. wouldn't let him alone. Why, he demanded, was Lumley improperly dressed in pyjamas instead of uniform? Lumley gave a great guffaw and says,
"Ah, well, you see, my overalls were so riddled with musket balls, they dropped off me."
They sent him home, which made me wonder if he was quite as tap as he sounded. That's mad, usually with sunstroke. For at least he got out of it while the rest of us must soldier on, waiting for Paddy to plan his next bloodbath. I had hopes of keeping clear, with my hand shot through and my supposedly bad leg. But once we'd settled in for Rosapore and taken stock, blowed if I wasn't the fittest junior in view. Munro, Somerset and Hoare of Harding's staff were dead. Grant and Betcher were wounded. Abbott wouldn't recover for weeks, and the toll among the politicals had been frightful, with Broadfoot and Peter Nicholson dead, and Mills and Lake badly wounded. It's a damn dangerous game, campaigning, especially with a sawbones as heartily callous as old Billy MacGregor. "Man, that's a grand hole in your hand!" cries he, sniffing it. "Nae gangrene or broken bones, you'll be gripping a glass or a gun inside the week. Your ankle? Ach, it's fine. You could play peaver this minute." That's Scottish barbarian talk for hopscotch. Not what I care to hear from my medical man in wartime. I'd been looking for a ticket to Meerut at least, but with political so scarce, there was no hope of that. And when saintly Henry Lawrence turned up to take Broadfoot's place, I was kept hard at it. Among other duties, seeing to the provision of fur boots for our elephants against the winter cold. Capital, thinks I, this is the way to serve out the war in comfort. For one thing now seemed plain, the Kalsar couldn't whip John Company. The bogey had been laid at Feroza Shah. India was safe, and while they were still in strength beyond the river, it remained only to bring them to one final action to break them for good and all. So for the present we sat and watched them, Gough awaiting his chance to strike, and Harding turning his mind to great affairs of state and political settlements. With Lawrence, who knew the Punjab better even than Broadfoot, at his elbow. He was shockingly Christian, Lawrence, but an A1 political for all that. He turned me inside out about Lahore and wanted me in at the high powwows, but Harding said I was far too junior and overzealous. The truth was he couldn't abide me and wanted to forget my existence. Here's why. We'd had a bloody close call in India, and it was Harding's fault. He'd failed to secure the frontier through pussyfooting and hindering Gough. And the stark truth was that when the grip came, two men had saved the day. Gough and I. I ain't bragging. You know I never do. Well, maybe about women and horses, but never about small things. I'd instructed Lal and Tedge's treachery, and Paddy had held his ragbag army together, got it to the gate in time, and won his fights. Or they'd been costly, and he'd fought head-on and taken some hellish risks, but he'd done the business as few could have done it, Harding for one. But that wasn't how Harding saw it. He believed he'd stopped Paddy from throwing the army away at Feroza Shah, and from that it was a short step to seeing himself as the savior of India. Well, he was Governor-General, after all, and India had been saved. QED. Indeed, he seemed to think he'd done it in spite of Gough. And inside a week of Feroza Shah, he was writing to Peel in London, urging that Paddy be given the sack. I saw the letter, accidental-like, when I was rummaging through His Excellency's effects in search of cheroots. and it was a beauty. Paddy wasn't fit to be trusted with the war. The army was unsatisfactory. He'd no head for bandobast. He didn't frame orders properly, etc. Well, dash my wig, thinks I, here's gratitude, and the measure of Henry Harding. Framing orders, my foot. No doubt, on you go, Mickey, give 'em one for me. Offended his staff college sensibilities. But he might have remembered another general of his acquaintance whose style wasn't very different. Stand up, guards. Now, Maitland, now's your time. If I'd been a man, I'd have scrawled it across his precious letter. It was plain why he was tattling to Peel, though. Shift the blame for the butcher's bill and the near squeak we'd had on to Gough. And who'd think back to the incompetence and fear of offending Lahore and Leadenhall Street that had helped bring on the war in the first place and damn near lost it? It was artfully done, too, with a tribute to Paddy's energy and courage. You could imagine Peel shuddering at the name of Gough and thanking God that Harding had been on hand. Don't misunderstand. I ain't championing the old Mick, who was a bloodthirsty savage, and a splendid chap to avoid. But I liked him, because he'd no side, and was jolly, and offended the quality by commissioning rankers and damn the royal prerogative. Aye, and by winning wars with his Tipperary tactics. Perhaps that was his greatest offence. Oh, I know Harding was an honourable man who never stole a box-car in his life, and that most of what he said of Paddy was true. That ain't the point. That letter would have been shabby if I'd written it, damn it. Coming from a man of honour, it was unpardonable. But it showed how the wind set, and I wasn't surprised, en route in farther through Harding's satchels. Most elusive, those cheroots were. To find a note in his daybook, politicals of no real use. So there, plainly Flashy would get no credit either. My work with Lal and Tedge would be conveniently forgotten. Well, thank ye, Sir Henry, and I hope your rabbit dies and you can't sell the hutch. I pondered about informing Paddy anonymously that he was being nobbled, but decided to let it be. Mischief's all very well, but you never know where it may end. So I lay low, running errands for Lawrence. He was a gaunt, ill-tempered scarecrow, but he'd known me in Afghanistan and thought I was another heroic ruffian like himself. So we dealt pretty well. He'd seen from Broadfoot's papers that George had been meaning to send me back to Lahore. But I can't think why, can you? Anyway, I doubt if the Gigi would approve. He thinks you've meddled enough in Punjabi politics, but you'd best let your beard grow just in case. So I did, and the weeks went by while we waited for the castle to move, and our own army recovered and grew strong. We celebrated Christmas with the first decorated tree ever I saw, a great fir brought down from the hills and sprinkled with flour to represent snow. Our Caledonians boozed in the new year with raucous mirth and unspeakable song. The reinforcements arrived from Umballa, and we saw the scarlet and blue of British Lancer regiments. The green of the little Gurkha hillmen strutting by with their knives bouncing on their rickety asses. The 10th Foot, with band playing and colours flying, and everyone pouring out of the tents to sing them in. For 'tis my delight of a shining night in the season of the year. Behind came native cavalry and marching sepoy battalions with sappers and artillery. Paddy had 15,000 men now, and the young Lancer Buck strutted and awe-hawed and asked when were these Sikh-wallers going to show us some sport, eh? God, I love newcomers in at the death, don't I just? There was one quiet Lancer, though, a black-whiskered Scotch nemesis who said never a word and played the bull fiddle for his recreation. He caught my eye then, and again 15 years later when he led the march to Peking. The most terrible killing gentleman you ever saw, Hope Grant. So, there we were, cocked and ready to fire, and beyond the river, although we didn't know it, Little Dalip's throne was shaken, for it was touch and go whether the Khalsa, raging in defeat and convinced they'd been betrayed, would fight us or march on Lahore to slake their fury on Jiandan and the Durbar. They'd have hanged Lal Singh if they could have caught him, but he didn't in a hayrick after Feroz Shah, and then in a baker's oven before sneaking back to Lahore, where Jiandan mocked and abused him when she was sober, and galloped him when she was drunk. Between bouts, she was sending messages of encouragement to our half-mutinous army, telling them not to give up, but to march on and conquer. At the same time, she shut the city gates against the fugitives from Lal's contingent, who deserted in thousands, and even ordered Gardner to recall a Muslim brigade from the front to protect her in case the Khalsa Sikhs came looking for her. Resourceful lass, she was, egging on her army while she turned her capital into an armed camp against them. Gulab Singh was playing the same game from Kashmir. The Khalsa pleaded with him to bring his hillmen to the war, and even offered to make him Maharaja, but the old fox saw we had the game won and put them off with promises that he'd join once the campaign was fully launched, while making a great display of sending them supply convoys, which he made sure were only quarter-loaded and moved at a snail's pace. Meanwhile, Tej Singh was scheming how to lead the Khalsa to final destruction. He had the bulk of them in hand, outnumbering us 3-1, and must do something before they lost patience with him. So he threw a bridge of boats over the Sutlej at Sobraon, and built a strong position on the south bank in a bend of the river where Paddy daren't attack him without heavy guns, which we still lacked. At the same time, another Sikh army struck over the river farther up, threatening Ludhiana and our lines of communication. So Gough moved north to contain Tej's bridgehead and sent Harry Smith to deal with the Ludhiana incursion. Smith, full of conceit and ginger as usual, stalked the invaders to and fro in the last week of January, and then handed them a fearful thrashing at Aliwal, killing 5,000 and taking over 50 guns, and that did rattle the Khalsa. But the beaten commander, Ranjore Singh, was a first-class man, and Smith had licked him with a smaller force, and no excuse of treachery this time. I was in Gough's camp at Sobraon when the news came through, for Harding was in the habit of riding the 20 miles from Ferozepore every other day with his new staff of toadies, to have a sniff and a carp at Gough's dispositions. And Lawrence always went along, with your correspondent bringing up the rear. A great roar of cheering ran through the lines, and Paddy fairly danced with joy, and then scudded off to his tent for a prey. Lawrence and other holy Joes took their cue, and I was about to sidle off to the staff mess, when I heard a great groan close by, and there was old Gravedigger Havelock, clasping his bony paws in supplication and looking like Thomas Carlyle with rheumatics. I never seemed to see that man, but he was calling on God for something or other. Possibly it was the sight of me that did it. He'd prayed over me like a mad monk at Jalalabad, but the last I'd seen of him had been his boots, viewed from under the pool table while I rogered Mrs. Madison. "Amen!" booms he, and left off addressing heaven to wring my hand, glaring joyfully. "It is Flashman, my boy, how long since last I saw you!" "Sales billiard room and similar," says I, not thinking, and he frowned and said I hadn't been there that evening, surely. "Neither I was," says I hastily. "Must have been some other chap. Let's see, when did we last meet? Church somewhere, was it?"
"I have thought of you often since Afghanistan," cries he, still mangling me fin. "Ah, we smelled the battle afar off, the thunder of the captains and the shouting.
Didn't we just, though? Now,
but come, will you not join your voice with that of our chief in gratitude to him who hath vouchsafed us this victory?"
"Oh, rather. But I say, you'll have to give me a lead. Graved, skipper, I mean. You always put it so dashed well, the praying, don't you know?" Which tickled him no end, and in two shakes we were on our hams outside Gough's tent. And it struck me, as I looked at them, old Paddy, Havelock, Lawrence, Edwards, Bagot, and I fancy Hope Grant was there too, that I'd never seen such a pack of born blood-spillers at their devotions in my life. It's an odd thing about deadly men. They're all addicted either to God or the devil. And I ain't sure but what the holy ones aren't the more fatal breed of the two. But mainly I recall that impromptu prayer meeting because it set me thinking of Elspeth again, when Havelock invoked a blessing not only on our fallen comrades,
but on those yet to fall in the coming strife, and on those dear distant homes which will be darkened with mourning under the wings of death's angel.
Amen, thinks I, but steer him clear of 13A Brook Street, O Lord, if you don't mind. Listening to Gravedigger, I could absolutely picture the melancholy scene with the wreath on our knocker and the blinds drawn, and my father-in-law whining about the cost of crape. And my lovely golden-haired Elspeth, her blue eyes dim with tears, and her black veil and black gloves and dainty black satin slippers, and long clocked stockings with purple rosettes on her garters, and that shiny French corset with the patent laces that you just had to twitch, and she came bursting out. Flashman was much moved, I thought, Havelock said afterwards. So I was, at the thought of all that voluptuous goodness so far away and going to waste. At least, I hoped it was, but I had my doubts. Heaven knew how many my melting little innocent had thrashed the mattress with in my absence. Brooding on that over supper and finding no consolation in port and fond musings on my own indiscretions with Jean, Dan and Mangler and Mrs. Madison, I found myself getting quite jealous and hungry for that blonde beauty on t'other side of the world. Time for a brisk stroll in the cold night air, I decided. We were stopping in Gough's camp by Sir Brown, so that he and Harding could bicker over the next move, and I sauntered along the lines, in the frosty dark, listening to our artillery firing a royal salute in celebration of Smith's victory at Aliwal. Barely a mile away I could see the watch-fires of the Khalsa entrenchments in the Sutlej Bend, and as the crash of our guns died away, hanged if the enemy didn't reply with a royal salute of their own and their bands playing. You'll never guess what. In some ways it was the eeriest thing in that queer campaign. The silence in our own lines as the gun smoke drifted overhead. The golden moon low in the purple sky, shining on the rows of tents and the distant twinkling fires, and over the dark ground between the solemn strains of God Save the Queen. I never heard it played so well as by the Khalsa, and for the life of me I don't know to this day whether it was in derision or salute. With Sikhs you could never tell. I was thinking about that and the impossibility of ever knowing what goes on behind Indian eyes, and how I'd misread them all, especially Jindan's, and reflecting that with any luck I'd soon have seen the last of them, thank heaven. And in that very moment an orderly came running to say, "Please, sir, Major Lawrence's compliments, and would I wait on the Governor-General at once?" It never occurred to me that my thoughts had been tempting fate, and as I waited in the empty annex which served as an anteroom to Harding's pavilion, I felt only mild curiosity as to why he wanted me. Voices sounded in the inner sanctum, but I gave no heed to them at first. Harding saying that something was a serious matter, and Lawrence replying that no time must be lost. Then Gough's voice. "Well, then, a fly-in column, under cover of dark, and going like Billy be damned, send Hope Grant with 2 squadrons of the 9th, and he can be in and out before anyone's the wiser."
"No, no, Sir Hugh," cries Harding. "If it is to be done at all, it must be secret. That is insisted upon, if indeed we are to believe that fellow. Suppose it is some infernal plot. No, oh, bring him in again, Charles, and find whatever has happened to Flashman. I tell you, it troubles me that he is named in this."
I was listening, all ears, as young Charlie Harding emerged, crying there I was and bustling me in, Harding was saying that it was almost precarious and no work for a junior man who had proved himself so headstrong. He had the grace to break off at sight of me and sat looking peevish with Lawrence and Van Cortlandt, whom I hadn't seen since Moodke, standing behind. Old Paddy, shivering in his cloak in a camp chair, gave me good evening. But no one else spoke, and you could feel the anxiety in the air. Then Charlie was back again, ushering in a figure whose unexpected appearance set my innards cartwheeling in nameless alarm. He sauntered in, no whit abashed by the exalted company, wearing his Afghan rags as though they were ermine, and his ugly face split into a grin as his eye lit on me. "Why, hello there, Lieutenant," says Jasser. "How's tricks?"
"Stand there under the lamp, if you please," snaps Harding. "Flashman, do you know this man?"
Jasser grinned even wider, and just from the glance between Lawrence and Van Cortlandt, I guessed they'd already identified him 10 times over. But Harding, as usual, was proceeding by laborious rote. I said yes, he was Dr. Harlan, an agent of Broadfoot's, lately posing as my orderly and formerly of Her Majesty's service in Burma. Jasser looked pleased. "Say, you remember that. Thank you, sir. That's proud."
"That will do," says Harding. "You may go."
"How's that, sir?" says Jasser. "But hadn't I ought to stay? I mean, if the lieutenant is going to—"
"That will be all,"
says Harding down his nose. So Jasser shrugged, muttered as he passed me that it wasn't his goddamn powwow, and loafed out. Harding exclaimed in irritation,
"How came Broadfoot to employ such a person? He's an American."
He said it as though Jasser were a fallen woman. "Yes, and a slippery one," says Van Cortlandt. "He bore a bad name in the Punjab in my time. But if he comes from Gardner—" "That's the point, does he?" Lawrence was brusque. He handed me a plain, sealed note.
"Harlan brought this for you from Colonel Gardner in Lahore. Says it will establish his bona fides. The seal hasn't been touched."
Wondering what the deuce this was about, I broke the seal, and had a sudden premonition of what I would read. Sure enough, there it was, one word: Wisconsin. "He's from Gardner," says I, and they looked at it in turn. I explained it was a password known only to Gardner and me, and Harding sniffed.
"Another American! Are we to rely on a foreign mercenary in the employ of the enemy?"
"On this mercenary, yes," says Van Cortlandt curtly. "He's a sure friend. Without him, Flashman would not have left Lahore alive." That's no way to boost Gardner's stock, thinks I. Harding raised his brows and sat back, and Lawrence turned to me. "Harlan arrived an hour ago. It's bad news out of Lahore. Gardner says the Maharani and her son are in grave peril from their own army. There's talk of plots to murder her, to abduct the little Maharaja and place him in the heart of the Khalsa so that the Panches can do as they please, in his name. That would mean the end of Tej Singh, and the appointment of some trusted general who might well give us a long war." He didn't need to add that it might be a disastrous war, for us. The Khalsa were still in overwhelming strength, if they had a leader who knew how to use it.
"The boy's the key," says Lawrence. "Who holds him? Holds power. The Khalsa knows it, and so does his mother. She wants him out of Lahore, and under our protection, at once. It'll be a week at least before we can finish the Khalsa in battle."
10 days, more like," says Goff.
"That is the time the plotters have in which to strike."
Lawrence paused, and my mouth went dry as I realized they were all watching me, Goff and Van Cortlandt keenly, Harding with gloomy disapproval.
"The Maharani wants you to fetch him out secretly," says Lawrence. "That's her message, given by Gardner to Harlan."
"Steady now," thinks I. "Mustn't puke or burst into tears. Keep a straight face and remember that the last thing Harding wants is to have Flashy stirring the Punjab pot again. That's your whole card, my boy, if this beastly proposal is to be scotched." So I made a lip, thoughtful-like, choked down my supper, and said straight out,
"Very good, sir. I have a free hand, I suppose."
That did the trick. Harding leapt as though he'd been gaffed.
No, sir, you do not. No such thing. You will keep your place until...
He glared, flustered, from Lawrence to Gough.
Sir Hugh, I know not what to think. This scheme fills me with misgivings. What do we know of these Americans and this Maharani? If this were a plot to discredit us...
Not my gardener, snaps Van Cortlandt.
The Maharani has good cause to fear for her child's safety, says Lawrence, and her own. If anything befell them, well, when this war is past, we should find ourselves dealing with a state in anarchy. She and the boy are our only hope of a good political solution.
Gough spoke up. And if we don't get one, we must conquer the Punjab. I tell you, Sir Henry, we have not the means for that.
Harding's face was a study. He drummed his fingers and fretted.
I cannot like it. Suppose it were made to appear that we were kidnapping the boy. Oh, it might be charged that we made war on children.
Oh, never that, cries Lawrence. We'd be protecting him. But if we do nothing and he is seized by the Khalsa, murdered perhaps, and his mother with him, well, that would not be seen to our credit, I believe. I could have kicked him. He'd hit on the best argument to commit Harding to this dreadful folly. Credit, that was the thing. What would London think? What would the Times say? You could see our Governor-General imagining the outcry if blasted little Dalip got his weasand slit through our neglect. He went pale, and then his face cleared while he pretended to ponder the thing.
Certainly the child's safety must weigh heavily with us, says he solemnly. Humanity and policy both demand it. Sir Hugh, what is your thought?
Get him out, says Paddy. You cannot do other.
Even then Harding must make a show of careful judgment, frowning in silence, while my heart sank to my boots. Then he sighed.
So be it, then. We must pray that we are not the dupes of some singular intrigue. But I insist, Lawrence, that either you or Van Cortlandt undertakes it.
He shot me a baleful glance.
An older head.
By your leave, sir, says Lawrence. Flashman, be good enough to wait in my tent. I'll join you presently.
So I left immediately, and was round the outside of Harding's tent like a frightened stoat, tripping over guy ropes and slithering in the frosty dark, before bearing up in the shadows with an ear cocked under the muslin screen of his window. The man himself was in full cry, and I caught the end of it.
Less suitable for such delicate work, I cannot conceive. His conduct with the sick leaders was irresponsible to a degree, taking it upon himself to determine policy. A mere junior political officer flown with self-esteem.
Thank God he did,
says good old Paddy.
Very well, Sir Hugh. Fortune favoured us, but his conduct might have brought us to catastrophe. I tell you what, the man's a swaggerer. No,
says this splendid and far-sighted statesman.
Flashman shall not go to Lahore.
He must, retorted Lawrence, for whom I was conceiving a poisonous dislike. Who else can pass as a native, speaking Punjabi, and knows the ins and outs of Lahore Fort? And the little Maharaja worships him, Harland tells me.
He paused. Besides, the Maharani Jandan has asked for him by name.
What's that to the point? Cries Harding. If she wishes her child safe, it is all one whom we send.
Perhaps not, sir. She knows Flashman and... Lawrence hesitated. The fact is, there is a bizarre rumour that she formed an attachment for him while he was in Lahore.
He coughed and hummed.
As you know, sir, she is a very lovely young woman, of an ardent nature, by all accounts.
Good God! Cries Harding. You don't mean...
The young devil, chuckles Paddy. Oh, well, decidedly he must go.
We'd best not neglect anything that will dispose her well to us, says Van Cortlandt, damn him. And as Lawrence says, there is no one else.
Eavesdropping fearfully, my mind filled with the horrid prospect of Lahore and its gridirons and ghastly bathrooms and Akali fanatics and murderous swordsmen,
I couldn't help recalling that Broadfoot had counted on my manly charms just as these calculating wretches were doing. It's too bad, but if your hell's delight with the fair sex, what would you? I've no doubt it's what persuaded that pious hypocrite Harding, with his mind fixed on political accommodations after the war. By all means, let Flashy humour the bitch while he plucked her bloody infant to safety, and wouldn't she be obliged to us just? He didn't say as much, but you could hear him thinking it as he gave his reluctant consent.
But hear me, Lawrence. Flashman must understand that he is to proceed in strict accordance to your instructions. He must have no room for independent action of any kind whatsoever. Is that clear? This fellow Harlan has brought directions from, what's his name, Gardner. A fine business where we must rely on such people, let alone this hare-brained political. You must question Harlan closely on how it is to be effected. Above all, no harm must befall the young prince. Flashman must understand that, and the consequences should he fail.
I doubt if he needs instruction on that head, sir, says Lawrence, pretty cool. For the rest, I shall give him careful directions.
Very well. I shall hold you responsible. You have an observation, Sir Hugh?
Eh? Oh, no, no. Sorry, Henry. Nothing of consequence. I was just after thinking, chuckles old Paddy, that I wish I was young again and spoke Punjabi. You never can say you've seen anything for the last time. I'd have laid a million to one that I'd not returned to that little stand of white poplars south of the Moochie Gate where I'd sat by the fire with Gardner. Yet here I was, only a few weeks later, with the flames crackling under the billy can resting on the selfsame red stone with the crack in it. To our right the road was busy with the wayfarers of daybreak. Under the great Moochie arch the gates were swung back. They were dousing the night torches, and the guard was changing. An uncommon heavy one, it seemed to me, for I counted 20 helmets in and about the archway, and since our arrival in the small hours there had been endless cavalry patrols circling the city walls, red lancers with green puggarees, and great activity of matchlock men on the parapets. "Muslim brigade," says Jasser. "Yes, sir, she's got this old town laced up tight on Jemima's stays. Waste of time, since any plotters will be on the inside, probably in the fort itself, among her own people. Say, I bet Alec Gardner's sleeping light, though." It was our third morning on the road, for we'd taken a wide cast south, crossing the Sutlej at a ghat near Mundol, to avoid any enemy river watchers, and keep clear of the Khalsa's main traffic on the upper road through Petit to Sabraun. We'd ridden in cautious stages, Jasser and I and a trusted Pathan ruffian of Broadfoot's old bodyguard, Ahmed Shah. Gough had wanted to send an NC squadron disguised as Gorachara, but Lawrence had turned it down flat, insisting that they'd be bound to give themselves away, and anyway, if all went well, three would be enough, while if it went ill, the brigade would be too few. No one would give any heed to three obvious Afghan horse-copers with a string of beasts, and thus far no one had. I shan't weary you with my emotions as we waited, shivering in the frosty dawn, round our fire. I'll say only that in addition to the blue funk I felt at the mere sight of Lahore's frowning gates and brooding towers, I had the liveliest misgivings about the plan whereby we were to spirit young Dalib out of the cobra's nest. It was Gardner's invention, lined out precisely to Jasser, who had repeated it to Lawrence and Van Cortlandt with Flashy palpitating attentively. And since our tartan Pathan wasn't there to be argued with, it was a case of take it or leave it. I know which I'd have done, but Lawrence had said it should serve admirably. He wasn't going to be the one sneaking in and out of Lahore Fort in broad daylight, after all. That seemed to me an unnecessary lunacy. Why the devil couldn't Gardner, with all his powers, as governor, have contrived to smuggle the brat out to us? Jasser had explained that the city was tight as a tanner by night, and the Panjshir's spies had their eyes on little Dalip most of the day. The only hour to lift him was his bedtime, to be out and away before curfew and have all night to make tracks. And we must go into the fort to do it, for his mother wouldn't rest unless she saw him placed under my protective wing. They'd all avoided my eye at this. Myself, I hadn't liked the sound of it above half. As to our coming and going at the fort, Gardiner would provide. All we need do was be in the vicinity of Runjeet's tomb at noon of this, the third day. So now you see three Kabuli copers herding their beasts through the dust and bustle of the Roshnai gate, and setting up shop in a crowded square by the Bugiwala Dudi at midday. Ahmed Shah cried our wares, asking exorbitant prices, since the last thing we wanted was to sell our transport. And I held the brutes' heads and spat and looked ugly, praying that no one would recognize Jasser with a patch over his eye and his hair and five-day beard dyed orange. He had no such fears, but loafed about freely with the other idlers, gossiping. As he said, there's no concealment like open display. I didn't see the touch made, but presently he ambled off, and I passed the halters to Ahmed and followed across the great square by the marble Baraderi to the palace gateway where I'd first seen Gardiner months before. There were no palace guards on the parapet now, only green-jacketed Muslim musketeers with great curling mustachios, watchful as vultures, who scowled down at the crowds loitering in the square. There must have been several thousand gathered, and enough Sikhs in assorted Khalsa coats among them to set my innards churning. They did nothing but stare up at the walls, muttering among themselves, but you could feel the sullen hostility hanging over the place like a cloud. "She ain't venturing abroad this weather, I reckon," murmurs Jasser as I join him in the lee of the gateway. "Yep, there's a sizable Republican majority right here. Our guide is right behind us in the palki. When I give the nod, we'll tote it through the gate." I glanced over my shoulder. There was a palki with its curtains drawn, set down by the wall, but no bearers in sight. So that was how we were to get past the gate guard, who were questioning all incomers. Even under my poshteen I could feel the sweat icy on my skin, and for the 20th time I fingered the cooper hidden in my sash. Not that 6 shots would buy much elbow room if we came adrift. All of a sudden the mutter of the crowd grew to a babble and then to a roar. They were giving back to make way for a body of marching men advancing across the square from the Hazuri gate on the town side. 6, almost to a man, from half the divisions of the Khalsa, some of them with bandaged wounds and powder burns on their coats, but swinging along like guardsmen behind their golden standard, which, to my amazement, was borne by the white-whiskered old Risaldar Major I'd seen at Myanmir, and again at Jiandan's Durba. And he was weeping, so help me, the tears running down to his beard, his eyes fixed ahead. And there behind him was Imam Shah, he of the ivory knives, bareheaded and with his arm in a sling. I was in behind Jasser, double quick, I can tell you. The crowd were in a frenzy, waving and wailing and yelling, "Khalsa ji! Khalsa ji!" showering them with petals as they marched by. But not a man so much as glanced aside. On they went, in column of fours, under the palace archway, with the mob surging behind up to the gate, taking up another cry, "See Delhi! See Delhi, heroes of the Khalsa! Hua Guru ji! To Delhi, to London!" "Now who the hell are they?" whispers Jasser. "I guess maybe we got here just in time. I hope. Come on." We laid hold on the palki and shouldered our way through the mob to the gateway, where a Muslim subedar, a senior subaltern, barred our way and stooped to question our passenger. I heard a woman's voice, quick and indistinct, and then he'd waved us on, and we carried the palki through the gate, and for all my dread at re-entering that fearsome den, I found myself remembering Stumps Harrowell, who'd been the chairman at Rugby when I was a boy, and how we'd run after him, whipping his enormous fat calves while he could only rage helplessly between the shafts. "You should see your tormentor now, Stumps," thinks I. "Hoist with his own palki, if you like." Our passenger was calling directions to Jasso, who was between the front shafts, and presently we bore up in a little secluded court, and out she jumped, walking quickly to a low doorway, which she unlocked, motioning us to follow. She led us up a long, dim passage, several flights of stairs, and more passages, and then I knew where we were. I'd been conducted along this very way to Geendon's Rose Boudoir, and I knew that pretty little rump stirring under the tight sari.
"Mungler,"
says I, but she only beckoned us on to a little ill-furnished room where I'd never been. Only when she had the door closed did she throw off her veil, and I looked again on that lovely Kashmiri face with its slanting gazelle eyes. But there was no insolence in them now, only fear. "What's amiss?" snaps Jasser, scenting catastrophe.
"You saw those men of the Khalsa, the 500?
Her voice was steady enough, but quick with alarm.
"They are a deputation from Tej Singh's army, men of Mutki and Feroza Shah. They have come to plead with the Rani for arms and food for the army, and for a leader to take Tej's place, so that we may still sweep the Jungi Lut back to the gates of Delhi."
The way she spat it out, you would have wondered which side she was on. Even traitors still have patriotic pride, you see.
"But they were not to have audience of the Durbar until tomorrow. They have come before that time."
"Well, what of it?" says I. "She can fob them off. She's done it before."
"They were not a beaten army, then. They had not been led to defeat by Tej and Lal, or learned to mistrust Mai Jiendan herself. Now, when they come to Durbar and find themselves ringed in by Muslim muskets, and call to her for aid which she cannot give them, what then? They are hungry men and desperate."
She shrugged.
"You say she has wheedled them before. Aye, but she is not given to soft words these days. She fears for Dalip and herself. She hates the Khalsa for Jawahir's sake, and she feeds her rage on wine. She's like to answer their mutinous clamour by blackening their faces for them. And who knows what they may do if she provokes them?"
"Red murder, like as not. And then we'd have some usurper displacing Tej Singh and reviving the Khalsa for another slap at us. And here was I, back on the lion's lip, thanks to Gardner's idiot plots. Should I throw in now and bolt for India? Or could we still get Dalip out before all hell broke loose?"
"When's the Durbar?"
"In 2 hours, perhaps."
"Can Gardner bring the boy to us beforehand?"
"Now?" "Run in daylight?" cries Jasser. "We'd never make it."
Mangla shook her head.
"The Maharaja must be seen at the Durbar. Who knows, Mai Jiendan may answer them well enough. And if she fails, they may still be quiet, with 1,000 Muslims ready to fall on them at a word from Gudana Khan. Then, when you have seen Mai Jiendan..."
"I don't need to see her, or anyone except her blasted son. Tell Gardner."
"Why, here's a change,"
says she with a flash of the old Mangla.
"You were eager enough once. Well, she wishes to see you, Flashman Bahadur, and she will have her way."
"What the devil for?"
"Affairs of state, belike."
She gave her insolent, slow smile.
"Meanwhile, you must wait. You are safe here. I shall tell Gurdana and bring word when the Durbar begins."
And she slipped out, having added bewilderment to my fears. What could Jiendan want with me? I thought it rum at the time, her insistence that I should be Dalip's rescuer. To be sure, the kid liked me, but she'd as good as made me a condition of the plan, to Paddy Goff's ribald amusement. Coarse old brute. But it couldn't be that, at such a time. Mind you, with partial females you never can tell, especially when they're foxed. But all this was small beer beside the menace of the Khalsa deputies. Could she hocus them again by playing her charms and beguiling them with sweet words and fair promises? Well, she didn't even try, as we saw when Mangla returned. after 2 hours of fretful waiting, to conduct us to that same spy-hole from which I'd watched an earlier durbar. This was a different indabar altogether. That's a matter or affair. Then there'd been tumult and high spirits, laughter even, but now we heard the angry clamour of the deputation and her shrill replies even before we reached the eyrie, when I saw at a glance that this was an ugly business, with the mother of all Sikhs on her highest horse, and damn the consequences. The 500 were in uproar in the main body of the great hall before the durbar screen, but keeping their ranks, and it was easy to see why. They were wearing their talwars, but round the walls of the chamber there must have been a full battalion of Muslim riflemen with their pieces at the high port, primed and ready. Imam Shah was standing forward, addressing the screen, with the old Risaldar major a pace behind. The golden standard lay before the throne on which little Dalip sat in lonely state, the tiny figure brave in crimson, and with the Koh-i-Noor ablaze in his aigret. Behind the purda, more Muslims lined the walls, and before them stood Gardner in his tartan fig, the point of his naked sabre resting between his feet. Close by the screen, Jiendan was pacing to and fro, pausing from time to time to listen, then resuming her furious sentry-go, for she was in a great rage and well advanced in liquor by the look of her. She had a cup in hand and a flagon on the table, but for once she was modestly clad. As modest, anyway, as a voluptuous doll can be in a tight sari of purple silk, with her red hair unbound to her shoulders and that Delilah face unveiled. Imam Shah was in full grievance, shouting hoarsely at the screen.
For 3 days your faithful Khalsa have lived on grain and raw carrots. They are starving, Kunwari, and eaten up with cold and want. Only send them the food and munitions you promised, and they will sweep the host of the Jangi Lattu.
Sweep them as you swept them at Ferozeshah and Mutki? Cries Jiendan. Aye, there was a fine sweeping. My waiting women could have swept as heartily.
She waited, head thrown back for the effect of this. Imam stood in silent anger, and she went on.
Kulap has sent you supplies enough. Why, every wheat porter in Kashmir makes an endless train from Jammu to the river, laden.
She was drowned in a roar of derision from the 500, and Imam advanced a yard to bawl his answer.
Aye, in single file, on pain of mutilation by the golden hen, who makes a brave show of assistance but sends not breakfast for a bird. Chiriya ki hazri, that's what we get from Gulab Singh. If he wishes us well, let him come and lead us in place of that bladder of lard you made our general. Bid him come, Kunwari. A word from you and he'll be in the saddle for Sir Brown.
Uproar followed.
Gulab, Gulab, give us the dogra for general.
But still they kept their ranks.
Gulab is under the heel of the Malkilat, and you know it,
snapped Jiendan.
Even so, there are those among you who would make him Maharaja, my loyal Khalsa.
There was silence on the instant.
You send him ambassadors, they tell me. I, in breach of your sacred oath. You whine for food on the one hand, and make treason on the other. You, the Khalsa, the pure.
And she reviled them in fishwife terms as she added Mayan near, until Gardner stepped swiftly forward and caught her by the arm. She shook him off, but took the hint. And none too soon, for beyond the screen the 500 were fingering their hilts, and Imam was black with fury.
That is a lie, Kunwari. No man here would serve Gulab as Maharaja, but he can fight, by God. He does not skulk in his tent like Tejo, flee like your bedman, Lal. He can lead, so let him lead us to Delhi, to victory.
She let the shouting die and spoke in a cold voice, ringing with scorn.
I have said I will not have Gulab Singh, and he will not have you. Who's to blame him? Are you worth having, you heroes who strut out to battle with your banners and brave songs, and crawl back whimpering that you are hungry? Can you do nothing but complain?
We can fight, roars a voice, and in a moment they were echoing it, stirring forward in their ranks, shaking their fists. some even weeping openly. They'd come for supplies, and what they were getting was shame and insult. "Keep a civil tongue in your head, can't you?" I was whispering, for it was plain they'd had their fill of her abuse.
"Give us guns! Give us powder and shot!"
"Powder and shot!"
cries Jiendon, and for a moment I thought she was going to be out and at them.
"Did I not give you both, and to spare? Arms and food and great guns? Never was such an army seen in Hindustan. And what did you make of it? The food you've guzzled, the British have your great guns, and the arms you flung away, doubtless as you ran cheeping like mice. From what? From a tired old man in a white coat with a handful of red-faced infidels and Bengali sweepers."
Her voice rose to a shriek as she faced the curtain, fists clenched, face contorted, and foot stamping. And beside me, Jasser gasped, and Mangler gave a little sob as we saw the ranks of the 500 start forward, and there was steel glittering amongst them. She'd gone too far, the drunken slut, for Imam Shah was on the dais, and the Khalsa coats were surging behind him, shouting with rage. Gardner was turning to snap an order. The Muslim muskets were dropping to the present, and Jiendon was fumbling beneath her skirt, swearing like a harpy. There was a rending of cloth, and in an instant she had whirled her petticoat into a ball and hurled it over the screen. It fell at Imam's feet, draping over his boot. There was no doubt in what it was, and in the shocked silence her voice rang out.
"Wear that, you cowards! Wear it, I say, or I'll go in trousers and fight myself!"
It was as though they'd been stricken by a spell. While you could count 10, there wasn't a sound. I see them yet, Anakali, his sword half out, poised like a gladiator's statue, Imam Shah staring down at the scarlet shift, the old Risaldar Major, mouth open, hands raised in despair. Little Dalip, like a graven image on his throne, the mass of men still as death staring at the screen. And then Imam Shah picked up the golden standard, raised it, and shouted in a voice of thunder,
"Dalip Singh Maharaja, we go to die for your kingdom. We go to die for the Khalsa Ji."
Then he added almost in a whisper, though it carried round the hall,
"We will go to the sacrifice."
He thrust the standard into the Risaldar Major's hand, and in that moment, unprompted, little Dalip stood up. A second's pause, and the whole 500 roared,
"Maharaja! Maharaja! Khalsa Ji!"
Then they turned as one man and marched out of the open double doors behind them. Gardner was at the corner of the screen in four quick strides, staring after them, then coming out to take Dalip's hand. Behind the purdah, Jiendan yawned, shook her red hair and stirred her shoulders as though to ease them, took a deep drink, and began to straighten her sari. Now, that is exactly what I saw, and so did Alec Gardner, as his memoirs testify. And neither of us can explain it. Those Khalsa fanatics, stung to madness by her insults, would have rushed the purdah and cut her down, I'm certain, and been slaughtered by the Muslims. God knows what would have followed. But she threw her petticoat at them, and they went out like lambs, prepared to do or die. Intuition, on her part, Gardner calls it. Very well, it did the business. Mind you, young Dalip stood up at exactly the right time. Jasser was breathing relief, and Mangler was smiling. Below us came a series of thunderous crashes as the Muslims ordered arms and began to file out of the chamber. Little Dalip was behind the purdah, being enfolded in Mama's tipsy embrace. But Gardner had disappeared. Mangler touched my arm and, signing to Jasser to wait, led me up to the rose boudoir. I felt exhausted even looking at it, and through to the passage beyond, and a little room which I guess must be the schoolroom of Dalip and his playfellows, for there were half a dozen little desks, and a blackboard, and even a globe, and fairy-tale pictures on the walls. There she left me, and a moment later Gardner strode in, breathing fire and wonder. "You saw that just now? God damn, but that woman's a bearcat for nerve. A bearcat, sir. Petticoats, by thunder. I wouldn't have credited it. Sometimes I think..." He paused, eyeing me with a curious frown. "I think she's a mite deranged, what with drink and... Well, no matter. And George Broadfoot's dead? Well, that's hard hearing. You didn't see it? Well, you have one as good in Henry Lawrence, let me tell you that. Maybe even better as an agent. Not a better man, mind you. No, sir, they don't come better than the black-coated infidel." He was standing, arms akimbo, staring at the floor, and I sensed disturbance. Not because he hadn't greeted me or made reference to my recent adventures, for that was never his style, but there was something on his mind, for all that he tried to cover it with a show of briskness. "It's past four, and you and Josiah must be clear of the gates before six. You'll go as you came, bearing the palki, but this time Dalip will be your freight, dressed as a girl. My Subedar will have the palace gate, so you'll be clear there. Once beyond the Russian Eye, keep to the Doab, due southeast, and Dawn should see you at Jupindar. It's about 40 miles, and not on the map, but you'll see it clear enough. It's a big cluster of black rocks among low hillocks, the only one for miles around. There you'll be met."
"By whom? Our people?"
"Gough wanted to buy sure people." He gave me a hard stare. "All you need do is get that far, and I don't have to tell you that you're carrying the Punjab on your back. Whoever gets that boy, it must not be the Khalsa, Malum. He's a good little horseman, by the way, so you can keep up the pace. Dawn at Jupindar, mind that. Due southeast, and you'll fall over it." For the first time, I felt excitement rather than fear. He had it pat, and it would do. We were going to bring it off. "What else?" says he. "Ah, yes, one thing. Dr. Josiah Harlan. I gave him a bad name to you, and he deserved every word. But I allow he's played a straight hand this time, and I incline to revise my opinion. That being the case, you'd better keep a closer eye on him than ever." "Well, that's all, I guess." He paused, avoiding my eye. "Once you've paid your respects to the Maharani, you can be off." Now there was something up. Gardner, uneasy, was a sight I'd never thought to see, but he was scratching his grizzled beard and keeping his face averted, and I felt a strange foreboding. He cleared his throat. Did Mangler say nothing to you?" "No. Well, oh, deuce take it." He looked me full in the face. "My G and Dan wants to marry you. There. Now." Heaven knows why, my first reaction was to look in the mirror on the classroom wall. A fierce-eyed Khyberi ruffian stared back at me, which was no help. Nor was my recollection of what I looked like when civilized. Possibly the Punjab had exhausted my capacity for astonishment, for once the first shock of that amazing proposal had been absorbed. I felt nothing but immense gratification. After all, it's one thing to win a maiden heart, and very fine. But when a man-eater who's sampled the best from Peshawar to Pune cries, "Eureka!" over you, well, it's no wonder if you glance at the mirror. At the same time, it's quite a facer. And my first words, possibly instinctive, were, "Christ, she ain't pregnant, is she?" "How the devil shall I know?" cries Gardner, astonished. "On my word, now, sir, I've told you, so there you are." "Well, she can't. I'm married, damn it." "I know that, but she does not, and it's best she should not, for the moment." He glared at me and took a turn round the room while I sank onto one of the infant's stools, which gave way beneath me. Gardner swore, yanked me to my feet, and thrust me into the teacher's chair. "See here, Mr. Flashman," says he, "this is how it is. My Jean Dan is a woman of strange character and damned irregular habits, as you well aware. But she's no fool. For years now she's had it in mind to marry a British officer as security for herself and her son's throne. Well, that's sound policy, especially now when Britain's hand is on the Punjab. For months past, this is sober truth, her agents in India have been sending her portraits of eligible men. She's even had young Harding's likeness in her boudoir, God help him. As you know, she has your own... Well, it was the only one she took to Amritsar, and the rest, a score of them, have been with the lumber ever since. Nothing to say to that, of course. I kept a straight face, and he took station in front of me, mighty stern. Very well, it's impossible. You have a wife, and even if you hadn't, I dare say you'd not care to pass your days as consort to an Eastern queen. Myself, while I admire her many good qualities, says he with feeling, I'd not hitch with Jindan for all the cotton in Dixie, so help me Hannah. But she has a deep fondness for you, and this is no time to blight that affection. Northern India's in the balance, and she's the pivot. Steady enough, but not to be disturbed in any way. He stooped suddenly and seized my wrist, staring into my eyes, grim as a frost giant. So, when you see her presently, you will not disappoint her hopes. Oh, she'll make no direct proposal. That's not Punjabi royal style, but she'll sound you out.